how about we don't try and make food perfect, because it's not perfect, just like life's not perfect.
If you're recycling, that's awesome. But you also need to look at all these other pieces, and you don't have to be doing them perfectly.
The first step is reduce, then reuse, then recycle. They are in order.
Get inspired by people fighting to make this world better for everyone. This is Unwasted with Imperfect.
Hello and welcome back to the Unwasted podcast. I'm your host, Riley Brock, and it's my honor every week to talk with experts in food, health, sustainability, and generally making the world a better, tastier place. Nothing makes you feel quite as warm, fuzzy, and cozy as eating some of your comfort foods from childhood. What is it about these meals that's so magical? How can they bring us meaning and connection across oceans and decades? Today's guest has spent her life exploring the magical power of family memories and recipes. She's turned this experience into a truly marvelous cookbook called In Bibi's Kitchen, The Recipes and Stories of Grandmothers from the 8 African Countries That Touch the Indian Ocean. In it, she shares the recipes of 8 African grandmothers and writes a moving and delicious love letter to African food that is also a thought-provoking testament to the universal power of family recipes. I'm honored to have her with us here today. Hawa Hassan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Riley. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
I'm super excited for this conversation. One thing I really love about your work is it has such a relatable and universally heartwarming theme, which is gathering together around the recipes and wisdom of our elders, and specifically our grandmothers. I'd love to start with, what inspired this approach to a cookbook for you?
Well, I've been long thinking of what was the conversation around African food and who was having it. And then my conclusion was that there was no conversation about African food. And if it was being mentioned, it was really being glossed over and kind of jumbled up together. And So I'd always been inspired by foods from the continent. I'd been inspired by the elders from the continent. I thought one way to preserve our foodways plus stories was to approach the book from the perspective of grandmothers. I'm someone who really adores the women that are in my life, especially the ones who've helped to raise me. And so this to me was a no-brainer. It kind of been a dream of mine that I'd been living with for a long time. And so I was really glad to bring it to life, especially in the times we're living in.
Yeah, that type of love and nourishment, I think now feels more important and poignant than ever, because everyone's spending so much time at home and kind of in this state of longing for things that used to be. I think it's, to me, it just seems is really poignant right now in 2020. Everyone's kind of disrupted and wants that comfort that they had as children.
Right. You know, it's all about moments of nostalgia, longing for things that, you know, remind us of home or outside or restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, a vacation that we once went on. And so I think this book really kind of serves all of that in its pages.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to get into talking about the grandmothers, but you brought up a great point at the start, which is that African food is woefully underrepresented and, like you said, kind of smashed together in America. Right. Can you elaborate a bit on that? Because I think I know what you mean, and I can kind of relate. Like, you know, for example, growing up in the Bay Area, there was Ethiopian and Eritrean food, but that was about it. And even within those two countries, I'm sure what I was eating was kind of this smashed and kind of approximated version of what you would actually eat if you went there. So I'm curious to hear, why is African food so underrepresented in the U.S. And you know, how has it gotten so distorted, do you think?
I mean, I think the answer is really simple. There are not a lot of African people in the food industry, and they're not invited to the conversation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can't expect an Ethiopian person that comes from a landlocked country to tell the stories and the food ways of someone who comes from, say, a place like Madagascar, you know, which has the longest coast in all of Africa in terms of being an island. And so, you know, it's Africa's not monolithic. It's 54 countries. It's 11.7 or 11.2 million miles long.
Wow. You know,
it's gazillions of tribes and languages and ethnicities. And so, you know, I always go back to Africa's not a country. And if we're going to represent it well, then we have to invite everybody from every African country to the conversation, or we have to make room for them to have you know, to educate us about where they come from.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. And to me, you know, if you flip the script and say, no one is just talking about European food as some monolith, or even like South American food as a monolith, like you, yeah. It's ludicrous to expect to talk about a continent in such simplistic terms. You know, continents are diverse, especially when it comes to food. So right. I think that's just a huge point to remember. You know, when you went about constructing this book, you know, it's built around the narratives and recipes of eight grandmothers. How did you meet these women?
I've said this in many of my interviews, but community is really important to me. It's the bedrock of my life. And,
yeah.
You know, this book is full of friends who helped to make it come to life. And some of the women are aunties of people who are in my life. Some of them happen to be women who raised people I went to school with or grew up with. And some of them were complete strangers that I met through friends who had either visited an island and met them or cooked with them. And so, you know, it in every way, this book is a reflection of the people that are in my life and the folks that I've met through my walks of life.
Yeah.
I lived in Cape Town. And so obviously it was a no-brainer for me to feature my friend Faith's aunt in Cape Town. And so it's a lot of that. It's overlappings of my life and just the people who helped make it come to life were folks I already knew.
Awesome. That's super touching too, that it's a personal history of your connections, but through you're using that as a fun framing lens to understand the diversity of African people and African culture and cuisine as well. I think it's very particular to you, but also I think very relatable to all of us. Cause I think if you were to ask anyone, like, you know, let's think of like eight kind of fun eclectic people, you know, and like what recipes are important to them, you'd come up with a pretty fun tapestry of stuff, even, no matter who you're talking to. So I think I just love that angle. You know, what do you hope people take away from this cookbook?
Well, I hope that when people open up this book, that they're able to see themselves in the book. You know, we've all got grandmothers. We all have spent some time in the company of a woman who's older than us in a kitchen, whether we were a child or older. You don't have to be a cook to have been in the company of your grandmother or someone else's grandmother. And so that's the first thing, is that I want people to identify with the book and for them to see themselves. And then the second is for people to adopt these recipes and familiarize themselves with the pantries of these countries, and then, you know, do a rift of those recipes in their own.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately educating yourself about African and Africa and African food waste through this book would, for me, be a dream. And then just realizing that these recipes are simple.
Yeah.
You know, that African food isn't difficult to come by. And I hope that this book helps to demystify a bit of that for people here in the West.
Amazing. You know, as I've read about you and learned about you, it seems that your mom is obviously a central figure in your life. I'm curious to hear, how did she kind of shape your relationship to food and cooking, and what lessons did she impart on you over the years?
Well, my mom is a businesswoman, so she doesn't do a ton of cooking. She spends lots of time traveling.
Uh-huh.
She's got 10 children. And so the eldest would be my brother, who's 35 years old. And my mom herself is in her mid 50s. And so you can imagine that her children and her have kind of grown up together.
Yeah.
And so very early on, what she did in order to afford herself time, she diversified everybody's, you know, energy by teaching us the things that we needed to do. She gave us the tools very early on to serve ourselves and to serve our siblings. And so, you know, as a little girl, I remember boiling pasta water. I remember, you know, being taught to make pasta. I remember making tea when company came over. But now, in terms of food, my mom spends a lot of time just shouting instructions and just allowing me to use her as a guinea pig to taste my food. But my sisters are really the cooks in the family, and my mom just kind of lets them, you know, she lets them own the kitchen.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's a good stage to be at as a parent, that you're more in the delegating role, letting other people do the work. It's definitely, I can relate to that for sure. I think a theme I've sensed in a lot of your work is, like we talked about at the start, the sense of longing and nostalgia. I think that's something really relatable that a lot of us are going through now in 2020. You know, how did that become such a central part of your work and your approach to cooking?
Well, because I was separated from my family early on, it's just naturally a part of who I am. You know, I'm somebody who exists in different worlds and takes up space and, you know, being the eldest girl in a family, but then also being an American girl who kind of grew up by herself. So almost an only child. So there's always been a longing of different worlds that exist in me. And so that naturally came through the book, because that's just the makeup of who I am. It's some dimensions to just innately how I was raised. And so it's odd that now we live in a time where nostalgia and longing is a universal thing, you know. 2020 has just awoken that in us, obviously, with the pandemic. But I have spent many days missing home and then thinking, where is home? And then cooking something that reminded me of my mother, or buying a perfume that reminded me of home, because I did long for the scent and the taste. And so in that way, the book is really reflective of myself, but it's also reflective of women who themselves have picked up and moved across the world and who raised children in countries where they didn't speak the language, or, you know, people who settled in a country that was at war but stayed. So, you know, longing, I think, takes many different forms in this book, whether it's for a home or a scent or a taste.
Yeah. That's super powerful and super well said. It strikes me that one of the most notable, or what I think admirable, things about your work is it's really giving a voice and an identity to what you're talking about. People that have been displaced, diaspora, immigrants, people that are, like you said, kind of caught between worlds. And you know, those people are not always represented in food media. I feel like, you know, people that are just in a country and like they're like represent that country tend to get more of the voice, especially if it's a white or Western European country. So I think it's really great that, one, you're giving voice and identity and recognition to these kind of people in transition, because I think so many people these days are that in that state, you know, literally or metaphorically. I want to dig in a bit on this idea of straddling worlds, because this seems to be something that's kind of it is a theme in your life and your work. I learned that you had spent time as a model in a previous life, but you didn't really feel at home in that world. What was that like, you know, modeling and just kind of feeling that you weren't quite yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's modeling, you know, thankfully maybe is a little bit different now, but the fabric of it, I'm sure, is still the same, because it's a systematic issue that drove me out of modeling. But it, you know, it's a place where you have to fit into someone else's idea of who you should be. And so, you know, if you're a Black girl who looks a certain way, but they don't identify as Black because you come from Somalia, that's an added element of, you know, exotic or different that's placed on you. And you must always live in that, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can't be many things in one. You have to be one form of who your booker or your agent or the client sees you as. And so that was really difficult for me, because I'd always had hopes and dreams of living out the many parts of myself without having to be confined in this idea that belonged to someone else. And so, you know, I think as a young person, it's really hard to create a space for yourself, especially when you're undoing some of your own traumas and then someone else placing these identities on you. And so, yeah, I didn't feel at home because I didn't feel like myself. I didn't feel like there was room to grow. I didn't feel that there was a desire for me to exist in that. I think it's a place that doubles down and supports people who look a certain way. And I didn't always fit that mold. So I'm glad to have that behind me.
Yeah. Interesting. So yeah, it sounds like there were just expectations that you couldn't or wouldn't fit, and that over time was just kind of too uncomfortable to stay with.
Yeah. It's, I mean, again, in any story, when you have to exist and live in someone else's story, there is no winning for you.
Yeah.
So
well said. You know, that touches on something you've talked about in food as well, which is this idea of tokenization, which, you know, I think America is going through a ongoing racial reckoning, especially, you know, it got pretty intense this year. And I think people are starting to unpack concepts like this that they've maybe perpetuated or been a part of or heard, but not really understood before. Can you share a bit about your experience going through tokenization as an African chef?
you know, I think that the food world is one that paints with one brush. And it's a space where the same type of people have been given agency. Yeah. And I think that I came into it at a time when there was really a cry for diversity, which, you know, I was coming from an industry that so desperately rejected diversifying and then, you know, or diversity. And then I was going into another industry that was like, oh my God, we're really bored with ourselves. We need, you know, we need to allow other people in, but we got to control what that might look like. And so, you know, of course I've been in spaces where I was given the seat because, you know, there was only room for one. But lucky for me, I don't do well in spaces where I'm not wanted or it doesn't feel authentic. And so, you know, I would love to say it's a thing that's taken over my life and, you know, go into it more, but I feel very lucky that my past life was one that made things so clear for me. You know, I know when things don't feel good. I know that when I go into a space and I'm the only one, I have power and that I can ask for others to come. And if the company doesn't want that, I also know how to reject the offer and leave. Yeah. And so I've done that many times recently and quietly, and it's really served me.
Sort of, choosing when to say no and when to say, you know, this isn't a great fit. This isn't true to who I am.
Yeah. And I think also too, like there's power in just saying no.
Yeah.
You know, if a company's ethos do not align with your personal ethics, you're not going to go in there and turn it around in the span of a year or whatever space they'll allow you to occupy. So it's okay for that company to internally get it together before you lend them your power.
Very well said. And that's, again, yeah, that's a very universal struggle, this idea of when and how to say no. But I think it's great that yeah, you're modeling that. Like, look, everyone should own what opportunities are a good fit for them and which ones you're going to politely pass on. I think that's huge.
Yeah.
In terms of kind of owning your identity in a food standpoint, you know, you're obviously an ambassador for Somali cuisine, which, as we talked about earlier, I don't think it's terribly well represented in the U.S. I'm curious to learn more about it here. You know, what are some of the key components of Somali cuisine?
You know, sweet and savory flavors that are reflective of the Indian Ocean. So cardamom, cumin, coriander, turmeric, cinnamon, black peppercorn, cloves. Those are really the bedrock of Somali cuisine. But, you know, bananas like this, riped bananas, pasta that we've inherited from the Italians, rice that is so, you know, that is so heavily reflected in many cuisines. But I would say if anybody wanted to know Somali food better, to study the Indian Ocean and the spices that have traveled across it, because you will find chutneys in Somalia, you will find chutneys in Lamu in Kenya, you will find foods that are our chapati is their dosa, you know.
Oh, huh. So it sounds like you can kind of unpack the history of trade and ingredients crossing the Indian Ocean through the cuisine.
Right.
Interesting. That's super fascinating. Is there one recipe that, or, you know, maybe probably a couple that you'd say people should start with, or is a good kind of entry point to understanding what you're talking about and how these spices combine?
Yeah, I would say that the sugo sukar is a really, really good, the Somali pasta sauce is a really good recipe that could help people understand, you know, Somali food ways, because it has all the components that I just talked about, such as the spice, the hawaj spice, which has the cardamom, the cumin, the cinnamon, the cloves. But that recipe is just, you know, olive oil, garlic, green bell pepper, a red onion, ground beef, the hawaj spice that I just mentioned, some salt, tomato paste, diced tomatoes, and just cook spaghetti.
Yeah.
And it really makes for a warm, savory sauce that you can build on and use almost on anything.
Wow, that sounds delightful. One, I'm definitely getting a bit hungry just hearing about it. And no, that's really fascinating. And thank you for sharing that. It does seem emblematic in that it's literally what you're talking about, the European influence of the Italian, you know, pasta being in the Horn of Africa, and then also obviously layering on all of these spices that cross that ocean through the spice trade. And yeah, no, that sounds fascinating. That sounds delicious. Definitely, you know, folks listening, pick up the book. It sounds just like such a fun and warm and inviting window into something that maybe you know, maybe you don't, but you don't know these eight women yet. So it's what a fun journey to go on. You mentioned spices, and I'm a huge hot sauce fan, so I have to ask about your hot sauce line. How did Boss Boss come to be?
Yeah, Boss Boss started kind of the same way the book started. You know, they're all in line of the many things I hope to build, but the condiments came about. I just had a deep desire to introduce people to cuisines from home for the things I longed for. And I thought, what better way to do that than through making hot sauces? The studies show that there was nothing like it in the market, and that people from the age of, I think it was like 22 to 35, were really experimenting with food because they're not traveling as their parents had done.
Yeah.
So I started it in hopes of inching my way onto the table.
Yeah. No, I investigated it. My brother's a big hot sauce fan, so I was literally thinking about getting some for him for Christmas. It's totally sold out, or it's on back order right now. So whatever you're doing it right, because your product's flying off the shelves.
I'm thankful that you are someone who reads, because there are a lot of people who order and then the next day they're like, where's my phone?
Right, like a nasty email or whatever. Yeah, no, I looked into it, but you're doing well for yourself. It seems like the hot sauce is generating that demand. And I mean, I agree with you. Like, until I heard about it, I didn't know about any other kind of Somali style hot sauces on the market. So it seems like it's a needed thing to, I mean, for hot sauce fans, but also for people to learn more about this cuisine. In terms of spices and kind of, you know, upping your game at home, I'm curious to hear, you know, folks, I think, like you said, they're not traveling as much, so they kind of want to stock their pantries in a way that they can, you know, travel as they cook. What are some of your go-to pantry ingredients? What are things you always try to have around at home?
I mean, I cook with a lot of coriander. I cook with a lot of cumin.
Yeah.
I cook a lot of smoked paprika, you know. We're not doing a lot of outside grilling, so if you want that smokiness, you know, paprika is a great one. I cook with mustard seeds and vinegary a lot. If you want that licorice taste, vinegary is great for that. I've been using a ton of coconut milk. You know, you can just get that in the can form. And then I've just been dressing up things that I have that I have not had the desire to always make, but I'll go buy it because it's available at the grocery store. Garam masala.
Mm, love it.
You know, people associate those type of spices with a certain cuisine, and it's like, no, you could use it on your roasted vegetables. I've been using barbere, the red clay looking dusty spice from Eritrea and Ethiopia. So I've been making that with halibut. I've been making that with, you know, and halibut hangs onto the spices so well. So that with like a squeeze of lemon has really served me. And then red onions. I really love having red onions or pickled red onions on hand. They just go well with everything.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing all that. That's great. I'm now like thinking about upping my spice game. Although my spice cabinet is always overflowing. I have a problem.
I know. I have, oh my God, I've got, I'm not even kidding. I have right now. I'm just going to show you.
Going on a journey.
Those are all spices.
Wow.
Yeah. Those are all spices.
She's got boxes and boxes of spices on our floor and just showed on video. That's astounding. Yeah. Definitely relate to that. You know, in terms of, We're coming up on the holidays as we're recording this, and I think gathering around food, it can be, you know, as you talk about in your book, such a grounding experience. I think for whatever reason, I've seen this in my life and in family members around the holidays, it can take on this really stressful energy. People can feel overwhelmed very easily, or just like they're in too deep, or, you know, they feel the pressure, expectations are high, or they're trying a recipe they've never done before. I'm curious, you know, you're such a seasoned cook. What tips would you have for home cooks to make cooking for other people, you know, easier and less stressful?
I would advise people to get away from the idea that food needs to be perfect. Mm. I would also say stick to what you're really good at doing.
Yeah.
Right. So if you are good at making a papaya dish, make that, you know, yeah. Don't go trying a whole entire new recipe, especially if it incites stress in you.
Yeah.
If you're going to try something new, I would say the idea of perfection in food is only something that lives on Instagram. It's not real. Even in our own kitchens, we've got food stylists. We've got people who, you know, think about in all the ways the colors need to be combined in order for the plate to jump off. We've got professional photographers. And so get away from the idea things need to be perfect. Make a recipe that you're very familiar with. And then another thing I would say, this has stressed me out in the past, is just make sure that you have enough dishware.
That's a great tip. 100% to that. Yeah.
You know, if you're having your immediate family and it's six of you, make sure that you've got the forks you like, the knives you like, the spoons you like, the small plates, that, you know, make sure your things are in order so that the day of, you're prepared.
Yeah. That's awesome. And I would add to that, do that ahead of time, because the worst time to realize you don't have the dishware is when your aunt or uncle or cousin are at your door expecting food from you. And then, you know, it throws you into this loop. And I've definitely caught myself in that in the past. But yeah, it's definitely, and you know, if you can do it ahead of time, it saves you so much stress. And that goes for all of the food stuff you talked about too. You know, double check those ingredients for that favorite dish ahead of time. The worst time to realize you don't have a red onion is, you know, when you're like going to chop one.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just prepare. You know, preparation is the best defense.
Yeah.
And if you drink, or if you like a spritzer, have something on hand so that you can get your nerves in control.
Excellent tip. And I appreciate you opening up that, like, look, you know, you've produced beautiful food photos for your Instagram in this cookbook, obviously. However, I love that you're opening up about the fact that, look, even I'm not perfect all the time. You got to move away from that if you want to cook awesome food for other people. Because I think it's hard when you experience so much perfectly plated food in your life. You know, you're consuming it every day visually. It's hard to not internalize that, oh, well, my food must look like that. And if it doesn't, I'm a failure, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
That's all on Instagram only.
Yeah. Well said. Nobody lives on Instagram. I think we would all do better to remember that and perhaps spend a little less time too.
Exactly.
You know, final home cooking question for me is, obviously imperfect is all about, you know, embracing imperfection, which we talked about, but also reducing food waste. And, you know, as someone that spent so much time in kitchens and, you know, thinking about recipes and food and cooking for other people, what advice would you have about how to waste less food at home?
So in Seattle, at my house, we have a compost, because in Seattle is really progressive, and they give you those little green bins that you can compost in. So that always makes me feel really good. Here in Brooklyn, I compost in my freezer. but I'm oftentimes testing recipes that I live alone, so I can't always eat them. And I'm in a pod with my neighbor. And so I give them lunch, I give them dinner, I try my best not to throw away food. If I see that something's getting ready to go bad, I freeze it. I love pureeing things and freezing them into little cubes.
Yeah.
So I can use them later on. If I know that my ginger is going to go bad, I'll shred it, or I'll chop it and put it in little cubes and put it in the freezer. But I, you know, I also walk to the grocery store every 4 days or so that I don't overbuy. I think we live in a place of overconsumption in this country.
Yep.
We have almost like a scarce mentality. So we like to hoard things. And I try not to do that for many reasons, because I live in a very small apartment in New York. But so yeah, those are some of the ways I don't waste.
I love that advice on wasting less food. I really appreciate what you said about the freezer. And my house rely on the freezer a lot. It's just a magical pause button, I think, when it comes to reducing waste. And, you know, recently I've been really experimenting with a lot of freezing excess vegetables. Like you said, you kind of buy yourself some time, and then you can come up with a plan, whether that's a soup or a sauce or a stock. And so I just really appreciate you sharing that. I think that's really sound advice for all folks out there. you know, I think we could go on about food waste probably all day here, but I do want to be respectful of your time and get to the fun closer questions here. So the first one I have for you is there anything we've talked about? You know, we covered a lot of ground here, from African cooking to tips for reducing waste to even your favorite spices, how your hot sauce line came to be. But is there anything we've talked about that you would encourage folks listening to dig into more on their own time?
I mean, I think that, you know, foods from other lands are an easy introduction into cultures. And so educating yourself about where garam masala comes from, the different variations of it, or the spice trade of the Indian Ocean, or how people use spices as a medicinal, for medicinal purposes in during the time of the trade. Just educating yourself through cuisine, I think for me, would be a dream if everybody got to know a bit more about the things they put on their table.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to read more food history books. And in addition to, like you said, tasting your way around the world and being a bit curious there, I think reading is such a great window too. Because like you said, there's so much history wrapped up in even one spice. You know, if you just dig into cinnamon, you know, where does cinnamon come from? How is it grown? Who was trading it? Yeah, definitely. You learn volumes. It's really cool stuff. What is a positive change you've made in your life in the past year that you think folks listening should try?
I mean, I'm not sure if it's positive, but I'm not as regimented as I once was. I have gotten to a place where I'm much more attached to the time I'm spending with people I love, as opposed to the expectation of the time or how much I can maximize the time. So I've made a good change in that I'm a lot more present than I was in the past year.
Amazing. If you're cooking for somebody and you want to make them feel loved, what are you going to make for them?
Ooh. I mean, I love roasting sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
Love roasting vegetables for people I adore, and just seasoning them a slightly different than they're used to. I love making warm soups. I'm heavy into butternut squash soup right now. I pack it in with ginger and a tad bit of cayenne. I also just love sharing like protein shakes with people I love. So I'm all around just doing really healthy things right now, and that's what I enjoy cooking and making.
Amazing. And now I'm getting very jealous for that neighbor you said you share all your leftovers with. Eating well.
I give them like the heavy stuff.
See, if you make too much of like a really rich sauce, you'll just send it over. That's awesome. That's really great. Yeah, we had Joel Gameron on the podcast, and he was kind of echoing something you just said, that in a way, like cooking a vegetable really delightfully for someone is almost the ultimate expression of love, because you know, most cooks can make a decent chicken or, you know, pork chop or beef or, you know, whatever your meat of choice is. But to make, like you said, a sweet potato just sing with love and affection and care, I think that's next level. So that's delightful to hear about.
Thank you.
What ingredient could you not live without?
Oh, what ingredient could I not live without? I love cumin.
Mm.
I feel like cumin can either play up a dish, play down a dish. It never really entirely takes over a dish. Can never have too much of it. So I really love cumin, and I love the many different ways I can use it, whether it's in my tea or in my stews or in my rubs.
Amazing. Yeah, cumin is delightful. We've had a couple guests mention cumin. I think it might be my favorite spice personally. I've never had it in tea, though. How do you make it in tea?
Oh, yeah. We make it in our like Somali chai tea.
Okay. It's just part of the blend?
You could use it loosely or you could use it whole, but you boil it into your water.
Awesome. I got to try that. That sounds delicious. What is your least favorite thing to waste?
My least favorite thing to waste. I don't like wasting spinach.
Mm.
I buy a ton of it a week. And so I sometimes find myself running out of time to use it. I think spinach and avocado for me are really tricky ones that have challenged me to be less wasteful.
Yeah. Do you have any tips for avoiding wasting spinach? Because that's something that we hear a lot from folks. It's really hard to keep, you know, especially tender greens like spinach alive.
So lately I've been just throwing them into my Vitamix and making a hot soup out of them. So I blend them a lot. I also use them in my juices. And then sometimes you could see me making spinach for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and that I'll use it in my eggs in the morning. The nice thing about spinach is that you could use it in many different varieties without feeling like, it, you know, like kale can take over a dish. And spinach is just a lot more softer in that it could easily fit into anything.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for the tip. That's a great tip. And changing gears here a bit, what is your go-to karaoke song?
Oh my gosh. Well, I cannot sing. I'm tone deaf, I think. But I do love, Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
Well, I also sing Shania Twain, Man, I Feel Like a Woman a lot.
Oh, that song is made for karaoke, I think.
It is. And then I like to sing Dixie Chicks, Wide Open Spaces.
Wow. Yeah. They're another good group for karaoke. Amazing. For someone who doesn't do karaoke, you have some great karaoke songs.
Yeah. Well, when you're not good at it, you have to know your song.
That's true. Yeah. You got to pick a real aggressive song just to distract from, maybe tone deficiency. I feel the same way. I'm like a pretty garbage singer, but if you're really into it, I feel like that's half the fun. You know, it's just the energy of the group.
I think so too.
Who is somebody you admire tremendously and what do you admire about them?
I admire my mother. I really look up to her and in the way that she treats other people. She's someone who's always acting from a place of integrity. I've learned recently in the past few years through her actions, just what it means to behave from a place of grace. Mm. My mother for her strength and her integrity.
Amazing. And finally, what are you grateful for this week?
I'm grateful for my home. It's warm, so I'm grateful for shelter. I'm grateful to have a fridge full of foods that I enjoy, and just for the support and love of my family and friends.
What a lovely note to close on, especially in this crazy, ridiculous, challenging year to be reminded of all of that. I really appreciate that. Hawa Hassan, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can folks learn more about you and the work that you do?
I think the most accessible place would be, Instagram, social media. So Hawa Hassan. And then just our condiments are at bestbestsauce.com. And then, just buying the cookbook and cooking your way through it would be helpful.
Amazing. We'll have links to everything we talked about today in the show notes, including your social handles, that cookbook, the amazing hot sauces, which are, as far as I checked, still back ordered, but I'm hoping you'll get more in stock soon. So folks, don't give up hope. The sauce is awesome. You got to try it. I really appreciate you taking the time today. We'll have links to everything we talked about, like I said, in the show notes and on our website, thewholecarrot.com, where this episode and all of our podcasts will live. So definitely check that out when you have a chance. Hawa Hassan, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Riley.